Do you feel continually let down by modern media? Do you miss the good old days, back when all that mattered was a good story and not some agenda? Do you have ambitions of picking up a pen and pad and fighting the creative war yourself? Then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I'm going to talk to a creator who said enough is enough and started making the content they wished was out there. Join us as we discuss the ups and downs of the self-publishing world. We want to help empower you to join the Iron Age of media. Welcome to Iron Age Marketing. Welcome, everyone, once again to Iron Age Marketing. I am Nikki P here today with Jacob Kelta. How are you doing there, Jacob?
I'm doing A-okay. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I try and have everybody who's interesting on, and you definitely are among the most interesting with your necklace and your sunglasses there, putting off a strong visual aesthetic, really branding yourself in a particular way.
Part of it's the fact that I dress the way I write my characters. So if I'm wearing one of these, there's usually someone with a Hawaiian shirt running around somewhere in the space.
Hunter S. Thompson, I get it.
I've been listening to a lot of the Gonzo tapes, man. That is some wicked, wicked stuff. But also, my funniest story about that, too, is when I was up at college still, I'd be going around in the denim, in the leather, with the cowboy boots and an actual bullet belt with genuine casings, 223. And I was treated like I was wearing a three-piece suit and a top hat to match. It was hysterical.
Well, as you should be.
If I had a nickel for every time I was asked, is that real? I'd be able to leave the school. Just pack up, be like, later. It was fun times, though. It was fun times.
Right on. Well, why don't you, we started here, and tell our guests a little bit about yourself and kind of where you come from and how you got into the space that you're in.
All right. So I am from the wonderful land of grass and more grass that is upstate New York. I'm from around the Cooperstown area. And I'm a filmmaker, writer, and composer. The first love was music because I had started arranging and transcribing by ear compositions around middle school. So like probably 12, 13 or so. And slowly I kind of developed my own musical voice alongside that. But while I was doing that, I was always writing stories. I was always making these dinky little short films where I was messing around with like iMovie. And for a time, was literally filming with the webcam off of my school-provided laptop. So I'm sitting there putting this laptop in positions it ought not to be in from a peer-to-peer, like, one-to-one laptop program and filming all of these ridiculous abstract things and really just having a ball, really just experimenting. And ultimately what happened was I went off to college in 2019. I got one semester in before everything went pear-shaped. And after 2 years of just banging my head against the wall in a kind of position where everything I wanted to do, I wasn't able to because it was almost like I didn't even need to be there. Like I was there because I wanted to use the resources, but I didn't have access to the resources after, you know, COVID shut everything down. And it ate at me. It ate at me as a creative. It just ate at me on like a personal mental level. And it was towards the end of 2021 that it all finally snapped. And I went back and revisited a concept I had for something. I'd sat down and just jammed out a couple pages of world building late in high school, the original Bible, which is since lost to time. And suddenly, things started clicking over the summer, and the more and more I thought about it, by the end of August, I was writing stories for what would become 365 Infantry, which is my digital Substack. It's a quarterly pulp magazine set in this wild science fiction universe that's basically far, far into the future after MAD has claimed everything except the very, very few to reemerge. There's this congealing of essentially the last hub of urban civilization and of all places, what used to be Phoenix in the southwest of the United States. And over the course of some rapid advancement, they wind up with a citywide computer network that runs the whole show for them. Essentially the first true post-scarcity society. Stop me if you've heard this before. And plot twist, it gains sentience. But because it is designed to maintain stasis and to perfect all that is not imperfect, it runs with this to a gradually increasing extremity that ultimately leads to everyone's favorite. Get rid of the carbon-based life forms. They're imperfect beings, you know, as you do. The twist of it is, though, it's all starring wolves, and the forces fighting against this misguided evil, for lack of a better word, is this resistance force based in the desert that wars almost exclusively with souped-up hot rods and motorcycles, armed to the gills with lasers, and just a total power fantasy madland that's Blade Runner, Mad Max, and Heavy Metal Magazine all rolled into one. And that gave me so much life when I needed it the most. And like, everything took off. I was writing more music. My film work became stronger. My voice, my creative, my drive went through the goddamn roof. And by the end of it, I had built something that I could write on almost forever if I didn't know how it ends. And that leads me to where I am right now, which is I am constantly pushing what I can do with the series, but also pushing what I can do as a fantasist, as a writer of speculative fiction, as a composer who works on scoring films as they come. In fact, I just finished writing music for one of my friends over in Sweden for a short film he did on the down low. And also, as always, working on screenplays and working on developing, I guess I'd call them audiovisual projects, because not all of them might qualify for film status. But it's just kind of a trigger, really. It was 365 was what set off everything else. And I'm forever grateful that it has, because it's also starting to find an audience.
Now, what does the 365 part mean, out of curiosity? I don't know. I've read through this stuff a little bit here and there. I've never quite put together the importance of that.
It is a combination of a real in-world explanation and a combination of a freaky story of happenstance. The in-world explanation is this. In an address from the general, the head of the force at the time the main storyline is taking place, Adam Knox, is holding an address on the anniversary of a massive battle that took place, I think, a decade prior. And he talks of one of the soldiers who made the final blow, which happened to be his own wife at the time, who ultimately gave her life on the field of battle. And what happens is, while she had restored a genuine 60s Porsche 356, but the thing he had noticed is that she had actually gotten the numbers backwards. The numbers ran 365. And they fall madly in love after he escapes his original work as a police officer for Haven, the name of the city, out once was Phoenix. Falls madly in love with her, and they kind of pal around, him with his Hemi Cuda and her with her Porsche 365. And ultimately what happens is, after the battle, after she ultimately finally has to throw herself at the beast to get it to die. The beast being these giant hovering tanks that are like a fever dream out of an old Jerry Anderson, like the whole Super Mario Nation Thunderbirds puppet thing. Like a fever dream out of that kind of universe. And she makes the ultimate sacrifice. And what he ultimately does is rechristen what was originally called the Emburyxian Ascensors, which is a very wordy Latin name devised by the previous general, Leo Godred, part of his fascination with history, Ambiorix being hero. Oh my gosh. That's getting into a whole different tangent. So I'm going to put it simply. He renamed the force both in honor of someone who had basically clinched a massive victory in their long ongoing campaign against this computer network known as ACES, and also as kind of testament to this seemingly never-ending fight, 365, 365 days in a year, a nonstop fight. That's the in-world explanation. It's a dual meaning of the nonstop fight for freedom and the kind of last remembrance he could afford his late wife. The real-world thing that cemented this is a bizarre story. Okay, so I'm a fan of Chinese food. Totally change of gears here. I'm a fan of Chinese food. And I, at school, whenever I felt like, hey, I'm sick of the food at the dining halls, they deliver to the door. The Chinese place delivers to the door. One night, I think it was in October, a few months into pre-production, after I'd sort of cemented an address from the general, although I wasn't set on publishing it just yet. I'd gotten my usual order. I'm a wonton soup man, got a little thing of crab rangoons. And after I'm done eating everything, I get down to the fortune cookie. And I will send you the photo. I'll send you the photo over Discord for photographic evidence. I crack open the fortune cookie, and it reads as follows. I can do it from memory. There are 356 days in a year. May all 365 of your dreams come true. The file name is an omen.jpg. And that was kind of what cemented me saying, if I'm being told this, and I'm not told many good things by fortune cookies, not that I've been told bad fortunes, just that it's all the generic, you know, solipsisms and whatnot. You know, it's just like, wow, that's a new one. Factory typo or okay. Fate. World may never know.
Wow, see, I was waiting for something like, the real world stories behind names are always funny to me. So a guy was in this band, Purveyors of Fiction, and we had a song called Orson Welles. And the song was, like, we always called it out on stage, it was 195. And it's because until, like, I actually wrote lyrics for it, it was the BPMs that the song was recorded at.
Right.
And that's how the guitarist would remember our riffs. It's like, what's tempo was the riff at? Okay, gotcha. Ultimately, the song became Orson Welles. I wrote it about, like, the misunderstood genius or unrecognized genius going on a killing spree and, like, killing 195 people. And, like, he's the last one just to prove how great he is and what he can get away with. But, like, I worked the whole song around this number 195 when the real world reason for it was just it was the BPMs of the song.
Oh, my gosh.
But it ended up, like, actually being part of the song. Because, yeah, fuck it. 195 is 195. I like it.
There you go.
So I'm always fascinated by the origins of, like, things, you know? Aesthetically, this is the most interesting thing for me is you clearly have really spent the time to work out your aesthetic. And the whole world kind of reflects that. I sent a video to you in the chat. It's of a short film that somebody did for the Proto Men song, Light Up the Night. And I don't know if you've ever listened to the Proto Men. You ever heard of them?
I think I might have heard them, but I don't think I've listened to them often.
They're a band that's based off of the Mega Man video games.
Hey, good stuff.
And so, like, they're...
Now you got me.
They basically... All of their songs are kind of, like, based on expanding the world of Mega Man and, like, the story and detailing it out and whatnot. But they're also, like, I don't want to quite call them power metal, but they're very, they've got a very Queen-esque rock aesthetic cemented into like this. Everything about them is highly stylized. And it's got this weird, like, this style reminds me a lot of the aesthetic that you have. It's definitely different. It's not the same thing because they have like a different angle that they take with it. But it was the idea of so much care and attention being taken to like really make this sci-fi world feel like it's expanding. And it's like, it's taking over every part of it. It's not just visual. It's not just literary. It's auditory. Everything is part of this. You know, and for them, that's like the heavily synthesized music, just lots of boom, 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 to give you like that, what do you call it? You know, that otherworldly, like, oh man, something bad's going to happen. I can feel it. We're just waiting for the shoe to drop. And one of the robots coming to take me away kind of thing.
Of course, of course.
So this is your baby, your creation. And I come across, we talked to a lot of people that have a lot of different angles in here. You know, as of like recording this past week, I released an episode with Declan Finn, who's just all over the map. Like he writes, he's like, oh, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Like I will try my hand at anything. I just want to tell stories. And it's different when you talk to someone who's just like, I've got this thing. I'm bought all in on this one thing. And I want to dive in as deep and build this one thing out as I can. Is that something that you just feel like you're drawn to, or is like maybe someday you'll find a place where you want to go and do something else, but for the time being, this is just all you can think about?
The funniest thing with me is that 365 often has become the project that takes the most work to put into it, but it has never stopped me from coming up with other story ideas. I have been writing have not yet fully published yet, but I've been writing fantasy. I've been writing horror. I've been writing mystery. Some of my screenplays tend towards classic murder mysteries in the vein of the giallo from Italy, or there's a lot of film noir that seeps into everything I do, because I consider, you know, writers like Philip Yordan and Billy Wilder to have written some of the best dialogue in the history of any medium, truly. But 365 is nice because it is such a specific setting and a specific world, but there is no limit to the possibilities within genres, within aesthetic expressions, because there is the very kind of obvious calling cards that there's the metal aspect with all the denim and leather, to quote Saxon, you know, and also a lot of the cyberpunk stuff that might, you know, lend itself more towards the classic, you know, Blade Runner aspirations. But I write stories that range from straight drama to having a bit of a humorous slant to it, where there's something being said, but it's being said with wit and with good humor. There is something that edges towards fantasy, but never fully gets there, because I like to have that little twist of the unknown. So you feel like the world is almost rooted in a defined reality. May not be our reality. In fact, it's probably as far as removed from our reality as possible. But within the language of that, there is still room for something you cannot explain in a world so full of things that if we were to see them almost instantaneously, it would take us a while to register. You know, it might not be on Lovecraft levels of undefinable, but it might, you know, you might take a little while to focus. But 365 is nice because it gives me such a broad enough palette to play around with that I'm never really limited by the project. And moreover, it's knowing that this thing is being nursed all the while I'm working on other stuff, because I've got a YouTube channel called Quality Candor that's focused more towards film and music reviews and stuff like that. Although I'm working on restructuring that. And I also want to do documentaries with that platform. But I also work as a editor for a film review site, A Fistful of Film. And of course, I am currently layout designer on Anvil, as we are getting close to having issue one finished, wrapped up and out the door. Fingers crossed.
I actually don't think I've had anybody on the show actually talk about Anvil. So you want to take a minute or two and kind of tell people what that is? I'd assume most people know, but...
You'd hope so, but no. Rich from Iron Age Media pulled in me and his co-host from Iron Age Nights with Drink with Crazy, Daniel P. Riley, and pulled together this kind of A-team to do Anvil, an Iron Age magazine. And we've got, we just locked in stories for issue two, and we're working on finalizing issue one. And essentially, it is kind of addressing some of my misgivings with the magazine market. Obviously, I'm not the designer nor architect of the concept overall. That's Rich. It's Rich's baby through and through. But I'm forever grateful for him to pick me to hop on the project, because it helps me address some of my many misgivings I've had with the magazine market as an independent author. And also as someone working within the indie space, where it's a world filled with, you know, short windows, maybe you never know when someone's even going to be open from time to time. Some people wind up just doing anthologies. Some people buy for magazines, but it's a once a year sort of deal. But the nice thing about Anvil is that it's one more possible way to get more authors, more comic creators, more critics a chance to really get published and get out there. And I think Anvil, too, it is in a very neat position because it's very much a speculative fiction style magazine with its roots in pulp literature. And it pulls on everyone, people who have gravitated towards the Iron Age, people who have come from the pulp rev side of thing, people who have come from the Comics Gate side of thing. It is, to use another of many metal puns that'll obviously be used later in the show, it galvanizes. It really does. It helps bring things together in a way that, like the Iron Age, after it was kind of christened, for lack of a better word, last year, has helped people congeal and audiences to start to kind of, well, find each other, but also find the creators they wish to support.
I chose the name of this podcast because I liked what was happening. I liked the work that was coming out. And it's like, I want to help more people make the content I like reading, you know? Let's make more of this shit happen. And Pete, it's hard for people to do it longer if they don't have any way to kind of monetize it.
Oh, for sure. My problem, too, is that no matter how much I look at the calendar and it says 2023, month of June, I'm the oldest 21-year-old probably on the face of the earth. There are probably a very few scant older than me. Because I look back to history, I've seen the richness, the vibrancy of the way pulp mags used to be. Like, even in the 50s when it was a racket of, you know, Manhunt and then everyone knocking off Manhunt, or Astounding Stories, everyone knocking off Astounding Stories, there was still so many opportunities for writers and creatives to get out there, get themselves published, get themselves, you know, made. You had EC Comics as well as you had DC, you had Marvel, and everyone firing at full cylinder, like just on a tear in that early half of the 20th century. And then slowly the opportunities started to dwindle to the point where there are only a handful of legacy magazines still left. And the independent market is just not in a position right now to be sustainable to people who want to really pursue writing in that, you know, idiom, pursue the short story and not constantly have to write the best-selling novel or, you know, come out with the Tolstoy epic. And so I'm glad, I'm proud to be a part of Anvil, and I'm proud that we've given this opportunity for both those who have been at it for years and those who are finally starting to come out of their shell and really make a name for themselves. I'm glad to have a magazine that gives them just one more opportunity to get out there, get their name read. That's the best damn pitch I can give you for Anvil.
So moving along a little bit here, we've talked about kind of where you come from. We've talked about what you're doing in the case of 365. Let's talk specifically about the marketing stuff. So as I said, the one more interesting things about you is that you're kind of doing this full package, like the audio, the video, the storytelling, and everything's kind of... Now, I will be the first to say, it kind of comes off a little disjointed sometimes. It's like, I'm never entirely sure what I'm clicking on, what it's going to be, because it is so many things all the time. But it's also, certainly from a content standpoint, it does keep me guessing, which means it's always sort of interesting. Like, what's it going to be this time? Like, what is he showing off? What's the thing here? Is this, you know, some song that he did with somebody where he, you know, or is this, you know, going to be, you know, a short story with a bunch of wolves? You know, I just never quite know exactly what it's going to be. Is that all conscious that you've chosen to do that? Or what is the marketing? When you're thinking about marketing, what does that mean to you for you and your work?
Marketing for me is, above all else, having a distinctive brand identity. Consistency, I think, will come in due time. But the truth of the matter is, I'm 21 years old. I'm trying to build this up from the ground. And naturally, as I evolve as a creative, as I evolve as an artist, things will tend towards just a general evolution. Like, one, the stories might change tone slightly, but they'll try to be within the set parameters of the world. You know, so there's never going to be a shark to jump. But, you know, all the multimedia stuff really is kind of building up, maybe not the... Because Illusion makes it sound like a house of cards, which it really isn't. But the multimedia angle...
Well, I'd say building up the aesthetic.
Building up the aesthetic.
Like, helps you understand it, feel it better.
Absolutely. And also, it's just kind of in a strange way, it's almost kind of a running way of making assets, where every project you can reincorporate into, like, a pitch reel. Because here's the other thing, too. A lot of the stuff that I do, I'm able to do for free, which is the crazy thing. Because the artist, obviously, I always pay my artist handsomely. Kevin John Jacob has been a stud for me because he basically had to learn how to do Anthro-style artwork with kind of that touch of Bluth in there. But still, there's a lot of his, because he's based in the Philippines, so there's a lot of his comic style, comic with two Ks, there. So it's kind of this East meets West sort of look to the series with that hint of noir throughout. But stuff like cards for Red Light Bites, Solar Joint Stories, those are all graphic design pieces done in free image editors. Some of the stuff that I've been doing for Act Vault, I've already bought my editing software outright. So long as my computer is still around, that editing software is still good as gold. And I'm able to kind of just push in all these different directions, not even in a spaghetti to the wall, see what sticks way, but everything that reinforces what the series is about. Doing Wolves of Steel with JVP of Ruthless fame, that was rich and rewarding project because not only does it really cement the metal side of 365 imagery, it also gave me a chance just to flex my muscles as a composer, because I wrote the B side, and also I was there arranging and I was there mixing and producing based off of this beautiful, beautiful core composition John came up with. And so there's that element. There's kind of a sonic element. There's Alan Firedale, which takes the series in a bit of a meta direction, I'll fully admit, but there is something kind of fun about having this halfway demented. It's, you can't tell if it's always supposed to be for the whole family, but it's kind of getting there, kind of production where you get to almost cut loose in a way and tell these stories that are probably at the furthest edge towards fantasy without being outright, you know, fantasy, because there's so many of these outlandish and crazy concepts being put on display. But you also hear audiobooks and stuff like that as seeds sown by doing that series. And then, of course, there's Ockvault, which is kind of an anything goes thing, where you now have a video element, but also by nature of it being a ARG or an alternate reality game, now you have people who have to start, dredging through the site looking for, hey, maybe there's the back of a URL here. What takes you from here to here to here? And these kind of rabbit holes readers and viewers can fall down and find these absolutely stomach churning. Because I say stomach churning like it's gross and gory. There's stuff that I do in Ockvault that psychologically kind of puts me a little on edge, because it really is the closest we've done to a horror project. Like, there's a video. Whoever finds it, have fun. Have fun sleeping after watching that.
Now I feel challenged.
Well, that's the fun too, is that you have all of these different vectors to tell stories. Because that also, at the end of the day, a lot of this is just about telling stories too. A lot of this, the interactivity, the many different vectors through which these stories are told, the core is to get these stories told. And some people are more receptive to audio versus straight prose. Some people are more receptive to comics than, piecing together a puzzle like Ockvault. But overall, marketing to me is, as you said, really reinforcing the aesthetic vision of 365, but also being able to give more. It's the old Yngwie Malmsteen quote, "How can less be more? That's impossible. More is more." And so long as it's of a respectable quality and can be pumped out both consistently, but with enough of a frequency to keep people's attention, that's kind of what I do with 365. And it kind of gives me a chance to breathe on all my other projects. So I get a chance to really sit down and focus more on the prose that I'd say want to send out to magazines, or the time I want to spend working on a documentary like for something like Quality Candor, or just writing music to write music. Because there's the old term, excuse me, there's the old term, I believe it's absolute music in the context of classical music versus programmatic music. Programmatic music meaning, evoking imagery, telling a story, whereas absolute music is just music expressed in and of itself. It contains all the components therein. It's a rewarding experience, but is not necessarily built around a central image or a central idea, like, say, a tone poem. And being able to have 365 concentrated on telling stories across various avenues and at a certain even pace kind of has given me the freedom in all my other projects, really. So I have the one thing that's really the workhorse project, and then everything else can kind of be tended to as needed without having to... Rush might not be the best word to use, because that makes it sound like I'm like filing everything out the door. But maybe rush is the word to use. It gives everything more time to gestate and more time to develop. So I can sit there, not think about wolves and cars, and think about, say, dragons and barbarian warriors or PIs on, dark rainy nights and things like that. It gives me something to almost balance myself with, and then go off into all my other pursuits.
No, it's I like the thing that I like about it, especially since like manufacturing content is a lot of what you do as a creative when you're doing the marketing thing, is how do I get people to look at it? So like the idea of a naturally multimedia based approach is immediately going to hit different vectors of promotion for you and give you things to put out on different channels just natively, which I appreciate. And I'm curious, as far as like communication with your audience goes, obviously you've got the Substack, it's kind of like the way you put things out. What do you do as far as kind of like the brand that's Jacob? What do you do in that regard? Like, are you doing like, do you have an email list? Like, do you like email collection outside of your Substack, things like that? Where you kind of communicate? Like, I'm in my head, I'm imagining like some of your characters, like doing like an actual email in character, like once a month to your audience to kind of keep that, you know, as you said, you work quarterly on a project for this, you know, ways to kind of keep things going out in between there.
I want to work on getting better at that, because the only, and this might also start spinning off into just talking about kind of the state of the independent market, especially in regards to fiction. My only real problem is that the people who I know really dig this series, I tend to have a one-to-one basis with them. Like, these are people who have come up to me. I've made friends through working on this series, honest to God. And they are some of the nicest people, some of the most supportive people out there. I know just people that will go the extra mile to really be there for you. And I've noticed this with a lot of writing projects. There tends to be almost this kind of silent readership where they're there, they'll hit like, they'll be viewing everything. I mean, issue 5, which was just released last week, best numbers. Some of the best damn numbers this series has done. Probably some of the most even numbers too. But I do wish I could kind of get in touch with kind of the audience more, because I've built up kind of a, not a substantial brand, but I've built up an online presence out of Twitter. Initially as kind of a film buff who occasionally starts posting music, you know, KG started posting music originally of the classical variety until I kind of fell into the synthwave thing and actually made a lot of friends with that too. But there does seem to be this kind of weird disconnect with 365 where the people who come up to you and say, hey, I really dig what you're doing here, that those are the people you wind up having the one-to-one conversations with, versus the vast majority of the readership that show up, read the stories and kind of just fade off. And I've had people who have actually done this. Like, I have one of my pals on Twitter, you know, I've made beforehand, but who really got into the series. I rarely get a chance to talk with him because he has a gig in real estate and he's always busy. But whenever we chat and I ask him, hey, what did you think of the series? He's like, no, dude, I love this stuff. But it's never an active acknowledgement of that. It's kind of a, when you wind up seeking it out more often than you wind up just receiving it out of hand. And I think there are a few ways to rectify that, but I actually might argue that one of the better ways, even beyond just doing more of the email-based offerings, is building up kind of community hubs. I've been thinking about it, and I might finally pull the trigger on doing like a Discord server, because I've actually been hearing that there are a lot of people that are opting more towards Discord over conventional social media. And as this kind of continual, it's like a weird blend of like nastiness, but then ambivalence follows, where it's like everyone taking jabs at each other and all of a sudden everyone falls back into shadow, which has kind of been what's happened to Twitter after a lot of the algorithmic changes. I think Discord might be a bit more of an interesting way to foster that kind of a relationship and that kind of an engagement with your audience outside of the actual, you know, average vectors. Like, you know, like the email list.
It's certainly a better way to do community.
For sure, for sure. And as to the idea of kind of latching on specifically to the idea of kind of doing like in-character email, I've been thinking about that, but I've always had kind of a hesitance. There's some guys who have actually done really good with this. A great example is Rob Rimes, the creator of Barbarian of the Storms, that wonderful off-the-wall sword and sorcery series. He created a chatbot of one of his characters, Fenric, that has actually been hitting it off pretty well. Actually, it's been getting a lot of engagement and a lot of people have been finding kind of this fascinating experience, I guess, for lack of a better word. And maybe, obviously, the rapid development of AI is not to everyone's pace nor to everyone's taste. So that's a tightrope you have to walk. But there is kind of an appeal, too, because there's a lot of stories told in 365 in first person. And if there's one thing I've been consistently told, it is that I have a very distinctive voice as a writer, not just with omniscience, but the way the characters read.
Oh, for sure. it's why I initially asked you, like, you do have, you have characters that would lend well to kind of direct communication with your audience. And it's like, if I remember, like, some of my favorite moments in, like, the early, like, back in 90s comic books, or when you'd have, like, it would be like a stupid letters page at the end of the book, but they'd do, like, it'd be in Spawn, but right, it'd be done in, like, the voice of Clown.
Oh, man.
You know, there's these little moments where you're kind of...
Oh, absolutely.
The characters are breaking the fourth wall talking to you. You know, the moments, like, where Deadpool is, you know, directly speaking to the audience. Those are fun moments, but only certain kinds of characters lend themselves well to that. And yours definitely strike me in that vein.
Well, that's also kind of part of the relatability aspect, because the old phrase I always wind up saying is, I like to write characters you'd like to have a drink with. Very, very personal kind of people. And that's not to say that I go easy on them. There are stories where people get beat to hell and back. I mean, perhaps the best example was the very first Urban Avengers story, where Lita gets the fucking shit beat out of her by this android in this hand-to-hand combat. And it's this wonderful opening volley for the character, because she's the slug line for her was, I think it was, looks like a hippie, shoots like a sniper, drives like a maniac. And so you have this kind of crazy, bat out of hell image for her. And she's fun. She has a lot of personality, but that never becomes, you know, oh, she just overcomes all obstacles. No, she gets her shit pushed in. It's almost kind of, it's like Aeon Flux, except that she actually did come out at the end the victor, you know. But I could see her. I could see Nick from Speed Freak Files really hitting it off, because there are a lot of, that's probably the most personable series within the overall structure of the franchise, for lack of a better word. Speed Freak Files has been kind of this very, just the dumb fun part of the series, but it's never, you never feel stupid for enjoying it, if that makes sense. It is just these characters going on these absolutely madcap adventures, but the guy tells it like he's Fred McMurray from Double Indemnity. So there's almost this kind of bizarre dignity throughout all of the twists and turns and absolute just uproarious kind of chaos that ensues in Speed Freak. But yeah, no, I could see some of those characters really taking off in that vein, and it might be fun because it might also be another avenue to tell stories in a very direct kind of manner.
Well, it's a way to, for me, it's all about keeping the constant communication with your audience, like, you know, and I don't necessarily even mean in like needing the feedback sense. It's a, you never want them to kind of forget who you are. You don't ever want them to lose that connection. And bottom line is, there's so much out there right now. It's real easy to just kind of forget something exists in the pile of content.
No, dude, that's actually, this might be where I'll dovetail into the kind of the way I've looked at the wider markets and what maybe advice I'd give for people who want to get into doing anything creative, you know, whether within the Iron Age space or just as an indie creator. The first thing is just to be kind to yourself, because you're going into a market that I would classify as not even competitive. I'd almost say it's worse than competitive. It's an apathetic market, because not in the fact that they don't care about the work, not in the fact that they don't care about the creations, but that there's a lack of one-to-one communication in that regard. There are very few cute person-to-person like interactions you wind up having. Compared to, like, say, the old days where you had to go to the editor, hand him the manuscript, he'd read it in the office, or, you know, you go to the book signings. For a lot of people who wind up starting out, it might feel, I'd say, alienating, especially considering how most of the action is online now. So you're never gonna, it's the difference between engaging on social media, but then you still feel like you're missing just a little bit of that human contact.
The thing that we need to remember is that the kind of people that tend to draw into this medium or this space are also not the most outgoing people in the world, we'll just say.
That's true. But I just say that because that's kind of the way that I felt, just kind of navigating through things. Because there are days where it's like, you know, it's easy to kick yourself for, why isn't this performing well? Why isn't that performing well? But that kind of does you no good.
Well, there's also a degree to which I think more creatives need to do better at setting the value and establishing the value in what they do. I can't tell you how many people I see out there that are like, oh, well, I'm, you know, doing this quick campaign and, you know, I might break even or have to pay out a little bit. And it's like, I can get that for maybe your first campaign where you're trying to establish a name, keep the price low. But at a certain point, like if you don't value your stuff enough to put a price on it that's worth having, no one else is. Like, value is entirely how you present and how you go out. And now, if you can't convince someone it's valuable, that's whatever. But that's, you need to be presenting that there's value there. And I think a lot of that stems from the guys in the space don't think that their stuff is valuable. Like, they're just so, they desire so much for other people to look at it and give them respect. They're not respecting themselves, I guess.
Oh, for sure. For sure. And that's kind of why I really started going in with the paid subscription on Substack and really going in with doing all these different avenues of monetization, because the core reason why every issue, every central issue is free is pure altruism. It's just because I grew up being exposed, you know, child of the internet age here. It's not even a sob story. It's just kind of an interesting anecdote. But I always wound up growing up with so many different storytellers in different avenues, whether it was being done through videos or whether it was fiction or whether it was web comics. And it was always stuff being literally shown for free. And on one hand, you know, it's like, oh gosh, wouldn't it be nice if we just all have access to everything everywhere all at once, to quote a movie title. But at the same time, you cannot sustain a project by just handing it all away unless you have a pretty lucrative main job. And the difference with me is that I wanted to make my work in the creative space my main job. I wanted to make my film work, my music, did this multimedia package my main job, which is why I really did go in and say, these are the stories that are going to be behind the paywall. Alan Firedale is a heavily taxing series to make. And it's why I've even hired on my announcer, Brendan, who actually does the audio editing. He edits all the dialogue, all the narration for me now, because it got to such a point that I'm just like, I don't know if I can keep up at this pace, even on the quarterly schedule, because it becomes such an intensive experience layering the audio, doing the sound design, and writing a musical score. Because I write stock cues that I can pull from, like a lot of classic television and radio, but you still always need fresh music. You still need a fresh sonic identity to kind of capture the atmosphere of each story. And that's the kind of stuff that you say, I can't give that away for, because that takes so much effort and so much energy. And the nice thing too about doing a project like this is something like the 2022 annual collection, which is packaging everything released across the year, doing a final proper polishing pass in editing, and saying, hey, you can bring it home on your shelves. Physical media is always the way to go. And the crazy thing too is, with the amount of stories I've been pumping out, I could feasibly do 3 books at the end of the year, because there is a serial that's being run on the Substack. Once a month, we do Steeled Spies, which introduces a spy character who I'd been developing since the very outset of pre-production, Roger Steele, in a story that was originally released in the 22 annual collection, but has carried on in a semi-self-contained form across the website. So it's a once a month thing. And that's literally when you add in the story released in the 22 collection, bound that all together, that's a novella. That's a 25 to 30,000 word book. All of the Flash stories, it might be a shorter read, but that's still another solid collection of fiction. And so that's been why I really am pushing, even if it comes down to me literally sitting there and making like the pitch reel saying, why 365? Why support this? Which I definitely will. It's something that I've been meaning to get on for ages now. It's just that everything kind of pulls at you in sequence. And so it's a bit of a program madness. But I want to keep that central core of the series always free all the time, but support it on the back of this kind of almost mount of original fiction and original music and original media that doesn't feel like I'm outsourcing or it feels like I'm selling out, but it all builds in and it all fleshes out the world as it stands.
Well, in an effort to let this get too out of hand lengthwise, do you have any like final things you'd recommend to anyone getting into this, ways to kind of build their audience, build their tribe, you know, quickly and easily?
All right. So I'd say, one, really establish your own identity, not just for a particular project, but also for how you present yourself. So that way people know exactly what they're getting every single time you're working on something, whether you're dropping your latest, you know, sword and sandal escapade, or you're coming out, you know, swinging with a noir piece. Establish a very distinctive, very definitive brand for yourself. Always, always be on the lookout for every opportunity you can, not just to advertise yourself, but also to engage with people honestly, to show that there's a person behind there, that it's not just some crazed lunatic up on the mountaintop writing these pages and flinging them out all over the place. Get down there and just be with people, really engage with them. And I'd say particularly with I wouldn't recommend anyone doing something as crazy as what I'm doing, because to be honest, you might have to be a clinical psychotic to do the kind of mass production I strive for with not just 365, but with all my projects. But consistency counts above all else. Not just a consistency of brand identity, but a consistent level of quality. Set the goals for yourself. Set, this is the time I write. Or if you don't feel like writing, this is the time I plan. Or if you don't feel like planning, this is the time I start advertising and start, you know, putting myself out there. And also, the other thing too is don't balk at any opportunity, aside from the ones that look like absolute get-rich-quick schemes. This is specifically in terms of magazine writing, but there's a tendency I've seen with some people to kind of like turn their nose up at things such as writing for, you know, the trad pub magazines, the stuff that's still around somehow, like Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction or, you know, Analog. But my recommendation really is to, those are magazines that pay good rates. And my point is just write and submit to as many magazines as you get your hands on. Because whether they pay a penny a word or they pay a dime a word, those are not only stories you could possibly swap around, edit, get into different places if they get rejected, but sit and say to yourself this: I write 10 stories, I send them out to 10 magazines, they all get rejected, I do revisions, I swap them around, they all get rejected again. You just wrote 10 stories. That's literally an anthology. You could bound those together and publish them on Kindle or Lulu, or there are always ways to turn these things around. And so, you know, the worst case scenario, you wind up having to go the full self-publishing route. But best case scenario, you just sold a story for a dime a word. That's not money to turn your nose up against. And it's another way to help kind of support you.
From what I've seen, so few of those are like exclusives. It's just like, hey, this is fit or not, and you still retain the rights to do what you want with your story. So absolutely.
Oh, absolutely.
At that point, it's almost like getting paid to advertise.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, in a way too, people might be like, oh, but who's reading them? And I'm like, I don't care if they can afford it, if they like the story and they buy it. At max, I wait a year and then I bound it in an anthology where it'll probably get more eyes read on it. You know, honestly. You have to always look at every opportunity and look at the opportunities therein. And that's kind of what I've been doing, not just with 365, but with Quality Candor, with the stuff I've been doing with Anvil, with the stuff I've been doing as a composer. You sink your teeth on almost anything you can get your hands on. And that's really kind of, one, that's the way you learn best is by doing. You know, there's the old Ray Bradbury phrase, you know, I defy you to write 52 bad stories in a row. It's impossible to be done. And it just, there's enough, if you give yourself enough avenues to cut your teeth on, the better and better you get, the more likely your stories will start to sell. And moreover, the more interested people will become in the products you're hawking. And that goes for everything. That goes for music, that goes for film, that goes for even if you're trying to just do the YouTube thing, even if you're trying to do like the essays or the videos or whatever, that still counts too. That still counts too. Because you're building up your awareness, you're building up your brand, and you're building up a consistent, identifiable voice, which in such a sea of content is very, very important. I like how weird 365 is, because when compared to a lot of things in the space, it's going to stick out like a sore thumb no matter how you look at the damn thing. But yeah, so though I guess the big things I'd preach to anyone is define yourself, define your brand, be as consistent as you can be in that voice, in your work. And be as rapacious about producing and promoting and engaging your work. And another good example I will say, and this might be a good thing for me to kind of round out the spiel on, cross promotions. I did a cross promotion with Kitson Chi, who's a wonderful Singaporean author who's been writing wonderful, wonderful fiction, fantasy science fiction, just a terrific pulp author. I hopped on his Babylon Black campaign, which the fellows at Tuscany Bay Books also did, which included one of Declan's book. I believe it was two of Declan Finn's books. I think it was the first in his Tommy Shaw series. And I think it was his first in White Ops. And I made a cool $70 off that cross promotion, which might not sound like, you know, oh my God, you're not rolling the greens. The truth of the matter is you're not going to make big money at the outset. No one does. But the point is, that's still, when you stack that win on top of, say, making money on the music with semi-frequent sales or people who are buying into the paid subscription, everything starts to build up. So that's why I say almost take every opportunity you can, because cross promotion is also a nice way to build brand awareness. Chia's audience is now being exposed to 365. And if I'm, you know, going out of my way to say, hey guys, I'm doing this with, you know, I'm doing this with this brand. People come over, they take a look and say, oh my God, he's working with Kitson. He's working with this guy who has this beautiful looking book. And then you also, it all trickles down to the guys at Tuscany Bay Books as well, who I'm sure when they hawked it to their audience, they're coming over saying, what's this 365 thing? Or who's Kitson Chi? You know, and so there's these various intersecting paths that happen with the cross promotion. So I think that's probably the one thing I'd also recommend is that a lot of authors maybe band together when you're doing the kind of Kickstarter Indiegogo thing and kind of have your works coming on as, you know, as add-on perks, because it's a nice, maybe not lucrative, but it's a good way to build that awareness and also to help put more money towards the project.
Right on, man. Well, hopefully people get some good stuff out of this episode today. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And I'm assuming that we'll do this again to go into some other parts of this.
Oh God, I hope so. I'll be another repeat offender.
Right on. Well, take care, everybody.
Take care.
Do you fancy yourself the next Tolkien, Lewis, or Barker? Maybe you just have something subversive to say. Hopefully this podcast is helping you, but maybe your ambitions are just a little bigger than you can handle on your own. Head over to ironagemarketing.com and let Nikki P. help ensure your book doesn't release to nobody.